Throughout history, people have travelled to and from their home and the workplace. As technology advanced and travelling methods became more sophisticated, more and more people could travel further and further. In the Victorian era, the arrival of the railways allowed for mass commuting to become a way of life for many people across the country. In this episode of Rails to Nowhere, we'll be exploring the origins of the Victorian suburb and how the nature of the railways dictated the growth and shape of those suburban regions. Hello and welcome back to Rails to Nowhere. My name, as ever, is Simon. Unfortunately, I'm not joined by Ella today. Following from their family emergency earlier in the year, they are again unavailable for recording because they are busy making sure that their master's dissertation actually is able to be submitted. So I am unfortunately by myself for the next two episodes, which means they're going to be a little bit lectury. It's not my favourite form of podcast, but it's where we are at the moment. Today we are starting a pair of episodes. These are looking at the changing shape of suburbia, the changing nature of who was living in suburbia, and the changing ways people were travelling within suburbia. These two episodes kind of come as a pair, and I'll be talking you through some of these key aspects of my dissertation research. So in the last episode, or the last main episode, me and Aaron were looking at how the motor car was providing new ways for people to travel in the 1930s. And in the next episode, I will be discussing how this was changing the shape of suburbia and how people were traveling around suburbia. But to set the scene for that, we really need to talk about the Victorian suburbia that came before. So today we'll be looking at a couple of discussion points on suburban development in the Victorian era. We'll be using a couple of case studies, notably railway towns such as Swindon and Crewe, but also the primary case study that I used in my dissertation, which was Walthamstow, for this era, as that's an area that I'm particularly familiar with. So one of the big things we need to think about before we can discuss how suburbia develops is, what do we mean by suburbia? And this is an interestingly difficult question to answer. By and large, most people think of suburbia as being an outlying area that is principally dependent upon a central area for its primary source of employment and economic stability, I guess, is what we're looking at there. This has become increasingly complex to define in the modern era as people have been able to travel further and further for work. You begin finding a lot of interdependencies and a lot of satellite towns. So I'm thinking places like Reading, Luton, Canterbury, etc., which, whilst they may offer a significant portion of their residents as workers to London, are nevertheless standalone settlements of their own, with their own town centre, their own employment centres, their own education, and their own commercial centres, and so on. It's important to note that suburbia is not necessarily a new concept when the railways arrive, but it is a reasonably new concept in the Victorian era. So early suburbs begin developing in places like Liverpool and Manchester, and around London, principally with the stagecoach providing a principal form of transport. This means that they're mostly limited to upper class and upper middle class people. But as we go through the 1800s and towards the 1820s and 1830s, we begin getting horse buses. So these are more mass transport, so they're able to carry more people and they do it more cheaply. They don't travel necessarily as far and as fast as a stagecoach, but they allow people to move slightly further from their place of work. We also find a lot of walking occurring. So people are walking and cycling from home to work, and this is actually done over surprisingly long distances, with records of people walking or cycling for several hours to reach places of employment. But by and large, employment and work are reasonably close together, certainly for most people at the start of the century, because most people are not walking massive distances. So we're thinking sort of mill towns where you have a mill and then you have housing not very far away. Most people have a sort of 10, 15, 20 minute walk to their place of employment. But as I say, initially we have horse buses and then we have trams, which begin to expand the nature of suburban areas and the distances that people can begin travelling. And they begin causing the development of suburbia. So if we're thinking about suburbia as being somewhere that is principally dependent on a central area for its employment and commercial and economic heart, we're realistically thinking of suburban developments as being places that are predominantly residential in nature. So you don't actually have very many places of work and commerce within them. You'll have schools, you'll have areas where people can have recreational activities, and you'll have small commercial settings such as shops for people to buy essential goods from, but you won't have large centres of employment such as mills or docks necessarily within the residential district. So this makes it quite hard to define suburbia for a lot of periods, and there's actually only a sort of small window where it's very easy to define exactly what we're meaning by suburbia. And in many ways, as we'll discuss in the next episode, suburbia is kind of an idea. It's an ideal that people have, especially in the 1920s and 30s. Indeed, it's arguable that a lot of people would not have used the term suburban or suburban living in the Victorian era. I'm kind of doing that historian thing of retroactively applying a name to something that existed in the Victorian era, which we now recognise as being suburban-ish. But not really what we'd actually call suburban anyway, and it certainly wouldn't have been described as that at the time. It's what we would now call the inner city. So where does the literature stand on this? Well, a lot of the literature spends a lot of its time talking about what is suburban and trying to define that. So we have Heller, who highlights that the complexity of defining suburban development is in the fact that a lot of it's not pre-planned, a lot of it's not pre-designated, and it does become quite messy at times. And we have Hawkes, who again demonstrates and talks about how it's a sort of idea. One of the big texts on this is Simon Webb's book on commuters, and he again talks a lot about how the idea of commuting and living in a dormitory area sort of develops across the period from the 1850s through to the 1950s and beyond. And we have people like Kellett, who argues that London suburbia ends about 20 miles with places like Redhill, while Simmons goes further and includes places like Reading and Brighton in that mix. So again, we're getting a lot of confusion and disagreement on exactly what we're talking about. So we're sort of talking inner city suburbia for this. It's also important and recognised within a lot of the literature that the railways don't create suburbia. As I say, you get the walking and the cycling, you get trams and horse buses, which begin driving suburban development and urban expansion. It's also important to note that most suburban developments within the Victorian era rely on a core settlement, even if that's quite a small settlement. So when we think about railway towns, places like Crewe, these grow up around a very small core settlement, but as soon as an industry is established there or some sort of railway station that allows people to travel into a central area is established, quite small settlements can begin to become quite large suburbs. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get onto Walthamstow slightly later. But it's important to note, and a lot of the literature, so people like Kellett, Hilton and Webb, who've written extensively on this, all agree that the railways are critical in the mass growth of suburbia that occurs in the later 1800s. So whilst they don't necessarily begin the trend, the far greater capacity and speed of the railways mean that suburbs grow exponentially during the later 1800s as compared to slightly earlier in the century. And it also enables the working class to begin to move en masse into outer areas, even if that's not always a consensual and optional action for the working class. It does allow for the working class to move or be moved into outer areas, especially in London, where there's a mass concentration of railways and a mass concentration of industries. So talking about London, let's sort of think about the special case that is London in this period. So London's long been a major city, and by the 1800s, it's the largest city in Europe. It's the heart of the growing British Empire, and it's not a surprise, therefore, that becomes a major trading and economic hub, a major employment hub, and it begins developing industries such as the docks and an amount of manufacturing. The first principal settlement in the area is that of Roman Londinium, as well as later the city of Westminster out to the west, and these become major hubs as the Industrial Revolution goes on. At the beginning of the 1800s, principally London has not grown much beyond its Roman boundaries. It's shrunk in the medieval period, regrown back out to its medieval boundaries, and there are slums in the outer areas, but by and large it's concentrated quite close to the core. This is principally because people are having to walk to their places of employment, which are principally concentrated on the River Thames, because of a lot of the economy is based on trade and the docks and so on. So people are tied to living near enough to the river that they can walk to and from. So this area that we're thinking of, we're talking about what's known as the City of London. So when I say the City of London, we think about the wider London area. It's a common and easy confusion to make, but actually we mean the City of London, or the square mile as it's sometimes known. This is the core original settlement within London's Roman and later medieval walls, which is, as its second name suggests, approximately 1 square mile in size. London is additionally surrounded by a series of rivers and valleys, which themselves allow for some population centres, such as Hampstead, Walthamstow, and so on, to begin developing on the river valleys, where sort of fertile lands exist, but they also limit the growth of the city. So, for example, to the south of the River Thames, there is a lot of marshland and a lot of swamp, and this limits the growth of London southwards. The area known as Southwark principally grows up because there's a bit of raised land which makes space for an island to be there, essentially. And as you go up the Lee Valley, it's hard to settle in the low-lying floodplains of the Lee Valley. And even to this day, in the Lee Valley especially, there is very little settlement directly by the river. So, as I say, any settlement is limited by the ability of its population to move around within it. And in London, there is no exception to this. As I say, originally, it's limited by how far can people walk, the fact that people want to be getting to and from the river to go to work. Some of the wealthier London residents are able to move out using the stagecoaches. So if we come to our main case study that we're looking at today, Walthamstow, for example, there was a stagecoach which ran from London down to Walthamstow, and this allowed for some wealthier people to live out there in houses. And this is not uncommon. Places like Greenwich, Hampstead and so on are all linked by stagecoaches into London, allowing for at least some people to have a nicer countryside life and to travel into London for their work. The first omnibuses begin running in the early 1800s. In London, this starts in 1829 or 1831, depending on which source you use. Accounts vary, and I think a lot of it's down to definitions of what is an omnibus, really. And this begins allowing for the working class to take advantage of horsepower and to begin moving further distances than they could have before, although in exchange for cost. Goods transport is principally by the river, which again limits how far the city can expand because you've got goods coming up the River Thames. But if you're moving things by the river, then that means that, like people, they can only be moved by road away from the river, and that again limits the growth of the settlement as goods can only sort of go so far by horse and cart in a reasonable length of time. However, the arrival of the railways really unlocks a much larger part of the surrounding area for absorption into the metropolis. The first suburban railway in London, and indeed arguably the world, is the London and Greenwich Railway, which opens in 1836, running from London's first railway station at Spa Road, which is just down the railway from London Bridge Station, out to the town of Greenwich, which we now think of as part of London, but at the time is a distinct settlement. And this marks the beginning of the railway age in London. Over the following 50 years, a web of railway services begins to spread out from the city as previously unconnected towns and villages begin to become an integral part of the metropolitan area. It's important to note that as the railways initially grow, they're not necessarily thinking about suburban and commuter services. So things like the London and Birmingham Railway, as I've mentioned before, are built with principal stations in London and Birmingham and a couple of principal towns as they pass through, but they're not necessarily built with the idea of people travelling from intermediate locations in mind. They're principally for intercity services, and later infill stations are added to some of the settlements that are served on the way. The railways also have another impact on the growth of suburbia in that they sometimes forcibly resettle people. They come in. For example, when Liverpool Street Station is built to replace Bishopsgate Station, the railway clears a large slum in that area and they are therefore required to replace that housing and to enable for people to travel in from areas such as Walthamstow to reach the city centre where their work is located. Now, the impact of the railways is actually quite profound. In Greenwich, for example, we can see a steady climb in population after the arrival of the London and Greenwich Railway in 1836 and the gradual spread of the routes and railways across the area is matched with growing population and also, as you might describe it, a decreasing class of population. So we go from the suburbs being just the preserve of the well-off who can travel by stagecoach to the working classes arriving in rows and rows of terrace houses. So in other suburbs such as Walthamstow and Surbiton, we can see the same effect as the railways proliferate to them through the 1830s and 40s, allowing for increasing numbers of people to travel and increasing number of people to live in these areas. It's also important to note, the railways just have a higher capacity than a stagecoach. A stagecoach can carry maybe 8 people, maybe a dozen at most. A railway train can carry hundreds. It's important to note that development is not always immediate and quick to take off, and this can make it a little hard to assess and analyse the impact of the arrival of the railway. But principally, we see a follow-on effect in so many places that we can draw the deduction that it is likely the railway that is triggering these developments. In Walthamstow, for example, a principal issue is that the original station, which is what we now know as Lee Bridge Station, opens some way from the original town centre at Walthamstow. So Walthamstow is a small village up on Orford Road, up at the top end of the High Street, as it is now. And this is a good couple of miles from the new Lee Bridge Station. So while population does begin to grow a little bit, it's still got the problem that actually to get from Walthamstow to Lee Bridge Station, you have to get the stagecoach. It's only after the Great Eastern Railway opens the new station at what we now know of as Walthamstow Central, but at the time was known as Ho Street, on the line out to Chingford. That opens in 1871, and it's only after that Walthamstow really begins to grow.
Hello, Simon here. Sorry for the brief interruption to the conversation. Just a quick shout out to say thank you to our fantastic patrons over at patreon.com/rails2nowhere. Our patrons help support the creation of Rails to Nowhere, contributing as little as just £2 per month to help fund the various costs that come with running even a small podcast like this one. In return, as a thank you for your generous support, me and Ella give you additional bonus episodes, a week's early listen to all of our normal episodes, and some extra early content and some extra content blogs. Otherwise, thank you for listening. Thank you to those of you who do support us. Thank you to those of you who are now thinking about supporting us. And let's return back to the conversation.
So let's look a little bit more detail at Walthamstow as our case study and just think a little bit more about how an area like this is developing. So Walthamstow in 1840 is home to around 3,000 people, which is not huge, it's not tiny, it's not nothing, but it's nothing compared to what it would become. And the railways reach Walthamstow initially in 1840 with Lee Bridge Station connected by the stagecoach, which diverts from serving central London and begins serving the railway station instead. And then in 1870, the Great Eastern Railway opens the new line through Ho Street Station, and in 1873 this is extended on through Hale End and into Chingford. We also notably have the Tottenham and Forest Gate Railway, which opens in 1894, serving the station Walthamstow Queens Road. This is what we know of now as the Gospel Oak to Barking Line on the London Overground. Some people may know it as the Goblin. And this is an often overlooked aspect of suburban developments, but it's how people are travelling orbitally and between suburbs as well is important to note. And this is especially important to note when we come to talk about the growing use of the motor car in the 1930s. These railways provide principally a domestic function. The Tottenham and Forest Gate Railway provides some long distance freight connectivity, but certainly the Chingford line is providing an almost entirely domestic function to Walthamstow. It's providing passenger trains along the line, and it's providing domestic goods, so things like coal and light goods and parcels, but it's not principally providing access to industries, because there aren't actually that many in this area. There are some within the Lee Valley, but mostly they are light industries. There are some industries connected to the railway at Ho Street and at Hale End, but a lot of these develop slightly later on in the period. For example, the factory up at Hale End is not connected to the railway until the 1910s. Traffic is principally driven by workmen's trains. So I mentioned earlier about how Liverpool Street Station demolished a slum, and the Great Eastern Railway was therefore required to provide access for workers to travel to and from new developments. And this came in the form of workmen's trains, which were cheap ticket trains provided early in the morning, which allowed for workers to travel into the city, and there are accounts of these being very oversubscribed throughout their journeys. And on this line, these are provided as far as Hale End eventually, but not all the way up to Chingford. And this is a common theme on a lot of the Great Eastern Railway's branches, that there'll be a point where the workmen's tickets end. And that's principally due to the agreement of how far out the railway had to move workers in this period. But this triggers a massive growth in the population of Walthamstow, the arrival of mass transport, of cheaper transport, and of forcibly resettled people results in the population booming to 300,000 by 1914. And even to this day, the population has not grown much beyond that, growing to about 350,000 in the 110 years since 1914. So in a period of about 50 years, we see a growth of around 290,000 people. And in the 110 years since then, we've seen a population growth of about 50,000. So we're really talking a massive expansion of these sort of areas. These areas and these developments look like when they arrive. Well, if we think about Victorian residential areas, we think of terraced houses, quite dense, quite walkable. Walking is the principal method with which people are moving around the suburban areas. They're not driving, they've not got their own personal horse and cart, so it's how far can you cycle, how far can you walk. Some of the further away areas, so there is a tramway set up eventually in Walthamstow, which has an interesting dual purpose. One is that it goes up to the forest to allow people access to the forest for days off. A lot of people in the era look at being in the forest as a good, or being in the countryside as a good way to improve the quality of a life, and they're probably correct. I mean, we still to this day think of that as being a good way to improve one's life. And the trams also go up into some parts of Walthamstow that are not served so well for the railway, so they allow for expansion of the suburbs. But the trams are feeding into the railway at Ho Street and at Lee Bridge and at St James's Street stations. The residential developments, when we look at them on the map, they are concentrating on these railway stations. We can see how they grow initially from a few small rows of houses near to the railway, and they spread out and out and out, getting further and further away over time. And as I say, they're quite dense, they're very walkable. You find that commercial locations, so shops, are distributed around the location. You find parks and schools and civic facilities being dispersed to a distance where people can reasonably easily access them from home. And this is one of the big areas, as I say, where we'll see some changes into the 1930s as people begin to be able to make those sort of journeys, those sort of local journeys over longer distances. And we begin seeing a concentration of those sort of facilities into hubs. And this is not just something we're seeing in Walthamstow. I want to make that clear. This is something we're seeing across urban and inner city areas, as we'd call them now. And it's something we're seeing in sort of planned towns. So whilst a lot of London's development is not centrally planned, it's not directed by a single body, although in Walthamstow there are the Warner Estates, which are constructed by one of the larger local landowners. In places like Bourneville and Saltaire, we're seeing, again, similar developments, although this time concentrating on a factory rather than a railway station. So it's interesting how we're seeing the distinction between sort of a mill town, where you'll have a mill in the middle and the housing is concentrated around that, and a suburban development where the concentration is around the railway station, which provides that access to the employment hub at the end of the railway. So we can see the railway station as being the stand-in for your mill or your other industrial facility that you'd have in a slightly older location. And it allows for people to live a little bit further away, which is for various reasons. Some people do it because they feel that it will be better for their health and better for their family. Some people do it because they have no choice, because they're moved out of the area or because there just isn't housing nearer to where they live. But these really dense Victorian terraces and city developments are not seen universally as a good thing. So the Victorian era has a strong sense of what we know of as paternalism. So this is the idea that the wealthy know best, that there are those within society, be they industrialists, philanthropists, religious leaders, etc., who know better what's good for the poor. Realistically, there's a lot of sense that the poor don't really know what's right for them, and they need guidance from their betters. And some areas like Saltaire and Bourneville always have this. So there's this sense that the part of the reason it's being developed by the mill owner or the industry owner is because they know best and they can lay out a area that has greenery and nice things for the population and provides them with schools, but doesn't provide them, say, with pubs and alcohol, for example. A lot of these sort of Victorian areas are set up by temperance followers who don't want their employees drinking because they think that it's sinful or bad for them for various reasons. Towards the end of the Victorian period, we begin seeing this sort of idea of overarching paternalism proposed to become a more state-oriented thing. In 1891, Frankfurt had adopted what is widely regarded as the first zoning code, which had decided where industry and housing and commerce and so on would occur. And over this same sort of period, we see a growing movement within Britain known as the Garden City Movement, which is looking to propose the idea of more centrally planning urban developments and residential areas and providing better distinction between the different uses of the city, but also in beautifying the city to provide greater harmony between the needs and the wants of people and their spiritual and physical and health needs, for example. The Garden City Movement is interesting. So its principal tenets are laid out in the book Garden Cities of Tomorrow, which is written by Ebenezer Howard and published in 1898. In it, he outlines what he fully admits is sort of inspired by communist thinking. So we're not far off Das Kapital and the Communist Manifesto having been published by Karl Marx. And the ideas that are being espoused by some of these movements are self-proclaimed to be inspired by communism. You might see some aspects of communist thinking within them. They're not necessarily they're not at all really what we would call communism now. I'm not here to provide a full lecture on the differences between what's in Das Kapital and the Communist Manifesto and what would later transpire in the Soviet Union and other communist states around the globe, but it is important to note that there are differences, and there are differences in the thinking, and certainly these sort of early considerations of what the Communist Manifesto means, they're certainly looking at how you would implement sort of communist ideas within a capitalist society. And part of the Garden City Movement, certainly as proposed by Ebenezer Howard, is that you would have a city essentially owned in trust by some wealthy individuals. So you'd get together six seven, eight wealthy individuals. They would buy some farmland. They would develop a semi-rural city. So the idea is that there's wide streets with leafy trees and leafy parkland and garden and front gardens and back gardens and lower density housing, which would provide a better, more healthy environment for people to live. And that this would be held in trust by those who had bought the land until such time as the people were able to sort of better run their own affairs through having lived in better spaces and therefore be better off. Also, the idea of the garden suburb is that it would increasingly separate out the different functions of a settlement. So you would increasingly have a distinct line between residential areas, commercial areas, and industrial areas. Industrial areas would be around the edge. They'd be served by a ring of railways, which would allow goods in, goods out, movement of that sort of thing. You'd have residential areas, which would allow for people to live and have recreation and education and so on. And then you'd have commercial areas, which would be distinct and centralized. This is beginning to look a lot more like what we would expect from a certainly a modern American city, but also to an extent British cities of the sort of 60s onwards. And this is really where we begin to see the origins of urban planning within Britain and the idea that actually there should be a greater plan. And in the next episode, we'll begin talking a little bit more about that. What we also see within the Garden City movement is this idea of lower density, wider streets, green spaces between houses, and that begins to necessitate more mechanized transport and begins to necessitate people being able to travel further than perhaps they could walk comfortably. And we'll talk in the next episode again about how those combination of ideas with the emergence of the motor car begins to give us suburbia as we would recognize it from the 1920s and 30s. So that brings us really to the end of today's episode. We have seen how we've gone from little villages to high density urban environments to an idea that we should be returning to garden England, to green and leafy villages, even if that's a village of hundreds of thousands of people, but it should still feel like a small English village. In the next episode, we will begin looking at the post First World War period and discussing how the Garden City movement, the new concept of urban planning, and the appearance of the motor car as a viable form of transportation really come together to give us the 1920s and 30s suburbia that we all know and, I guess, love, I don't know, and how that leads to real changes in how suburbia develops and how that begins to lock in modes of transport throughout the period and beyond. And we'll talk a little bit about why that causes us challenges and problems today as we try and maybe move cities back towards the sort of walkable urbanism that the Victorian suburb was required to be built around, because it was really the only way that people could travel around areas. So thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed the podcast, then do consider supporting us on Patreon. We're at patreon.com/RailsToNowhere. You can find the podcast at RailsToNowhere on Twitter and Instagram, and you can find me at Little Red Dragon on Twitter and Instagram. But otherwise, thank you for listening, and I'll speak to you in the next episode. This episode of Rails to Nowhere was presented by me, Simon Sardis & Co. Rails to Nowhere is produced by me and Eleanor Ashton, with research for this series of episodes carried out principally by myself. Rails to Nowhere is brought to you by our fantastic Patreon supporters over at patreon.com/RailsToNowhere. So thank you for your support. If you'd like to support them, you can do so for as little as $2 per month. And you get in return some extra early content blogs, some extra sneak peeks behind the scenes of what we're up to, and early releases of all of our main episodes and extra bonus episodes. The most recent one was on Charles Tyson Yerkes, which went out just the other day. We're especially grateful for those of you who support us at the £10 and above level on Patreon, so especially big thanks to Valkyrie Lemons for your support. Thank you for listening, and without any further ado, see you next time.